Tired of juggling sales tools or spending hours on prospecting just to book a few meetings? Meet Apollo, the go-to-market platform for finding leads, connecting with buyers, and closing deals all in one place. Apollo gives you access to over 210 million contacts and AI that handles all your busy work, finding leads, drafting emails, and even prioritizing your day. So stop paying for five different sales tools when one does it all. Visit apollo.io and sign up free today.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whims of the wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light, riding the waves that are just out of sight.
It's time for Whimsical Wavelengths, your auditory dose of science every 2 weeks. And today the topic should do more than just whimsically tickle your ears. Today I have a guest. To get the slobbering sensor in your mouth working, yeah, buckle up for a flavorful ride. Here on Whimsical Wavelengths, we've covered so much from biology, astronomy, and astrophysics, volcanoes, and geology-related stuff. What about food science? The intersection of biology, chemistry, and the culinary world. Sounds delicious, right? But it also brings up a few questions. Like, what's a food scientist's favorite kind of music? Well, it's gotta be heavy malt, right? Or what's a food chemist's favorite movie? The Yeast and the Furious, right? Okay, well, maybe I won't ask those questions. But I guess definitions first. Food science is a discipline that investigates food chemistry, food microbiology, physical and sensory properties of us, and nutritional properties of food. The discipline also gets into the process of making the food with respect to the manufacturing, preservation, quality assurance, and development of food products. If your favorite snack is, bet you can't eat just one, it's practically guaranteed that a food scientist has been involved at some point in the process. Fast food restaurants, when they change their menus or bring in limited time items, they get help from food scientists. It isn't just big business side of things either. Creating staples that are enriched in required nutrients and vitamins. Wow, we just have to look at flour here in Canada. Commercially available flour must be enriched in B vitamins, iron, and folic acid. But what makes food taste good? From Michelin stars to the home kitchen, it's our taste buds that tell the brain what is yummy and what is yucky. In total, there are five elements of taste: saltiness, sourness, bitterness, sweetness, and savoriness, also known as umami. I remember growing up and seeing a diagram of the tongue showing different areas were sensitive to different tastes. It's not really true, and I have no idea where that came from. In reality, taste can be detected by any area of the tongue, but the science behind getting those receptors to fire and send delicious wavelengths to the brain is all about chemistry. Nothing like organic chemistry to make my head spin. I tried really hard to keep away from it during my bachelor's of science, and yet here I am. Thankfully, I have a guest that will come in and give us a rundown of what a food scientist is and how science is used to create deliciousness. Please welcome to Whimsical Wavelengths, Dr. Brian Lay, a food scientist, food industry consultant, and author of the book, 150 Food Questions Answered, and more, but I'll let him describe himself more. And thanks for being here and joining Whimsical Wavelengths.
Thanks, Jeff. Really appreciate you having me here.
So maybe just tell a little bit about yourself, because I know that there's always this journey that happens, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I completed my PhD in food science in 2020 during the pandemic. And so at that time, I wasn't able to find a job. So I ended up, kind of just throwing a shingle over my head and started consulting with food companies, not really thinking whether or not it was going to work out. But luckily, I'd written this book, 150 Food Science Questions Answered, during my graduate program. Incidentally, just for fun, because I was so bored with my dissertation. It was my way of having a break. So in any case, I started pitching my services to different food startups and food companies. And since then, I've just, last 5 years, I've just been working on all sorts of different projects, and especially involving flavor with these companies.
I dug into your backstory a little bit on your website, and it's not a common thing to hear a kid say, you know what, I want to be a food scientist when I grow up. You know, it's astronaut, it's doctor, it's... So how did you get to that point where you were doing a dissertation in food science? Because I just from doing a survey of other people that come on the show and my own friends and people within academia, there's often some meandering paths. And I think you skipped over that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, ultimately, I never even knew about the field of food science. And really, if you want to get to where I started, I did really well in college. I had a major in chemistry and I graduated. And after college, I ended up not really wanting to go down any of the typical paths. Like, I didn't want to get involved in pharmaceuticals, and I didn't want to get involved in petrochemicals or, biotechnology and so on and so forth. So I took a break, and I walked across the country for about 2,000 miles, went from California to Louisiana. That took about 6 months. And during that time, I was really, really fascinated by the fact that, the things that I was eating had really, really strong impact on how much I could walk and, how far I could walk. And I just got really fascinated. I'd spend a lot of times in the grocery store and just looking at food labels and just like wondering in my head, like, how is this ever made? And then after I came back from the walk, I was just kind of meandering with different programs and doing different studies until I found a research paper on flavor chemistry. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is a field. Like, people actually do this. And then I realized I discovered the field of food science, which incidentally there's only about like 40 universities or 50 universities in the United States that offer it. They're mostly state universities or state sponsored in some way with an agricultural program. And so I threw in my hat for a couple applications for a PhD program, and I got in, and I just kept going. And that was really exciting to be able to actually study something that I felt was really pertinent to me, and obviously is very pertinent to a lot of people, because everyone has to eat, right?
For sure. And I think that just goes to show one of my things that I always say, if you love the topic, go get a PhD. If you don't love the topic, don't do it. Whatever you do, don't do it. And that's always my advice. If you love it, you won't regret it. If you don't love it, chances are you're going to regret it. It's just what happens. Okay, so you've explained how you got to where you are and a little bit sort of what you do in the sense you consult with other companies, but you didn't really explain what that entails. And somebody's like, food scientist and food chemistry. So do you have a lab? Do you go to companies and just start talking science to them in a way they understand? Like, what do you actually do as part of this?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really broad. And of course, it basically means I'm kind of a scientist for hire or a mercenary of sorts. So for example, there is a company I worked with, they were making plant-based meat and they were having issues with their flavor system. And so I'll look at the composition and evaluate, read through some papers and see if I can kind of suss out exactly what the issue could be, and I'll provide some solutions, and then they'll play around with it, come back to me and say, well, this worked, this doesn't work. And then I'll keep providing more information. So in a lot of sense, I'm more or less a translator for research papers.
A translator and problem solver.
Yeah. Translator and problem solver. Yep. And, as much as I love being in a lab, I tried to construct one in my house, and that didn't really sit well with my wife. And so I had to like sort of scale that back. And then I ended up, working with the university, and then that didn't really work out because I couldn't get grants. But ultimately, the consulting ends up being a lot of emails, a lot of meetings. It's surprisingly a lot of talking. So that's really what I do, is I just take information that is already available, but kind of stuck in some kind of esoteric research format. And I give it to people who don't have the background, but, you know, are interested for one reason or another, whether they're, you know, a company or they're a lawyer who's on a case, or they're, you know, they're just like a, you know, small business mom and pop shop who, you know, maybe they have some issue with food safety. So those are kind of the bread and butter of what I do.
Perfect. And you're going to apply that skill of interpretation and translation for us here on Whimsical Wavelengths. So the journey to any science, and we've already kind of gone over some of the questions of why, and such a simple question of why we do or why we have to change something or the problem that we're trying to address can be extremely complicated. And I've given you the primer that I've yet to record in the intro. So why don't we just start really simple and then try to build into the research itself and start with taste. As my understanding, being a geophysicist, we have sour, bitter, sweet, salty, and savoriness, or termed umami. It seems we understand four of these really well. And the last one that is hard for an English person to pronounce because it's not something we're used to, umami, is less so. Why?
Yeah, so, you know, the four... I'll do an overview of those, the five basic tastes. So with saltiness, you know, you're really just talking about minerals, right? Mostly sodium. And that's, you know, that seems to be a very linear effect. Like the more sodium you put in, the saltier something tastes. And then sweetness, same deal. You know, of course you have sort of high intensity sweeteners, but mostly if you have sugar and it just becomes sweeter, that's pretty standard. Easy to understand. The problem is that when you arrive at umami or savoriness, umami is a little tricky because the main factor that causes the sensation of umami is glutamic acid or glutamate. And that's an amino acid that's found highly prevalent in most proteins. So it's basically an indicator, just like sugar is an indicator of, sweetness is an indicator of sugar. And that's, you know, helps you, you know, have energy, right? Prehistoric humans were searching around for sweet things because it felt good to them, but it's actually so that they can have the energy through carbohydrates. The same thing is with umami. It's sort of an indicator that there's amino acids. And in nature, amino acids are actually quite rare because nitrogen is a scarce element. So in any case, umami has that as its primary driver, but it actually has...
If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblokes.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
Secondary synergies with other compounds, mainly ribonucleic acids or ribonucleotides. And what will happen is, like, let's say you have a soup, for example, and it's got a lot of glutamates from some source. Let's say it's from mushrooms or from tomatoes.
And a glutamate is?
A glutamate is an amino acid. So yep. It's one of the 20 amino acids that we have in our proteins. So yeah, if you have that, the more glutamic acid you have, the more intense the umami is. And it's very linear. But you throw in a ribonucleotide, which is those components of RNA, essentially, and they will amplify it in a nonlinear fashion. So suddenly you'll have something that tastes amazing, but you actually only have very, very small amounts of these two components, right? So there's all this math that gets involved. And then it gets even more complicated because those ribonucleotides can then react to stuff when you're cooking. So they can react with sugars. They can react with sulfur-containing compounds, mainly from garlic and onion. And suddenly now their intensity is, you know, from sevenfold to 50-fold. And it gets, it's pretty wild, actually. So we really don't understand it very well on that end. And then on the other end, there's actually cultural differences and genetic differences between different people from parts of the world. There was a study that showed that East Asians have more pronounced sensitivity to umami compounds than people from Western Europe of Western European ancestry. And, you know, as far as why, it's there's a lot of speculations, but overall, basically, you've got scientists, you know, from Japan that's, you know, can clearly indicate a very particular sensation versus, you know, scientists in Britain who, you know, have no clue what you're talking about. So that's it took a long time for umami to actually have credibility in sort of the international scientific circles. And only when I think it was in 2002 or 2005, where, you know, some biochemists discovered the umami receptor, you know, and except umami has been known since 1908. That was when it was first discovered by a Japanese chemist.
Wow. So I guess that explains a lot of why we know so little in comparison to the other tastes. It's just because there's a evolutionary component that we don't fully understand. And it must, we'll come back to this, I'll circle back, but there must be some way of choosing a population to test your food on whether or not it's going to be good at the grocery store and make you money. But first, I just have to ask, because I remember it as a kid and then very quickly threw it out because I was like, I taste sugar everywhere. There was a diagram of the tongue with areas that were sensitive to different tastes. And as a young kid, I always thought it was dumb. And obviously it's a complete myth, but where did it come from? Like, why does it exist and still exist today?
Yeah. So it's actually quite nuanced. So, you know, of course, at first, it seemed like there's this sort of partition between different tastes. Of course, like you said, that's kind of debunked. And then the next step up was that all the taste receptors were evenly distributed across the tongue and mouth. But then the third level of that, it turns out that the distribution is unequal. Now, you'll still have bitter or sweet or salty taste receptors, you know, at the tip of the tongue. But actually, there's quite a few bitter receptors at the back of the tongue, and this actually changes depending on the person, right? Your sort of genetic heritage, as well as what age you are, and how much you've been eating certain types of food. So if you're a type of person that has been eating a lot of bitter foods, your bitter receptors will actually die back and sort of give you an indication that a lot of the foods that you've been eating has been fine. And then if you've been eating mostly sweet foods, you'll sort of have an increase in the number of sweet receptors. But the whole premise is like, you want to have a lot of bitter receptors in the back because bitterness is an indication of poisons and toxins. So by the time some food gets back there, you're like, oh my gosh, like, you know, the intensity just increases more and more. And at some point you just spit it out. So there's some, you know, biological reason for the distribution, but ultimately, you know, the taste buds are found throughout. They just, you know, some of them are a little higher, a little lower. So there's some indication that that's true, but it also is dependent on each individual.
So is that also the reason why, I guess, and at least I think in English, we have a phrase, the bitterness in the back of my throat?
Like, yeah.
Use that. Is that where that comes from?
It comes from, if you can believe that.
Wow. See, I love doing this podcast. I learned so much. And some of them are just nuggets that you'd have no idea where it came from otherwise. Okay. Right. So I'm going to pivot to MSG, monosodium glutamate. It was added to a lot of food. I can't remember when it started being added, but now it is somewhat frowned upon and regulated. Mm-hmm. So what is MSG? Why was it added to food? And then why was it, I mean, it's not fully removed, but it's certainly regulated.
Sure, sure. So glutamic acid, so MSG, monosodium glutamate, is basically glutamic acid that's been basified once, so that now it has a sodium ion attached
to it. So what does basified mean? It just reduces its pH in solution?
Yeah, it increases its pH, actually. Right. So then one of the acids,
right.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, you got to flip it, right?
Yeah, sorry.
Or H is actually a smaller number, right?
Yeah.
more protons.
Reducing the acid, increasing the base.
But I know.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
Yeah. So basically, you've changed basically the solubility. That's why you want to do that, because glutamic acid on its own is not soluble at all. So it's pretty... doesn't work very well in a food substance. And then if you add another sodium, then it tastes pretty awful. So it tastes like soap. So having only one sodium on there is kind of like that nice balance. So it's pretty close to a pH of 7, kind of a neutral pH. But in any case, so MSG was discovered by the same Japanese chemist who discovered umami, right? So he was playing around. And he realized that, you know, the soup that his wife made, this sort of seaweed soup, had a really interesting umami flavor. So it was something that was known culturally in Japanese, but he was like, as a chemist, he was like, why is this so particular, this sort of savoriness so particular in this soup? So he spent a year just like extracting the crap out of, excuse my language, out of, you know, 20 kilograms of seaweed. And he discovered that the principal compound is glutamic acid. Now he had to figure out, because he didn't, I think there was a businessman that was like, hey, I think this is a really cool idea. Let's start a company. And they started the Ajinomoto company, which is well known for producing MSG in Japan. But he had to figure out a way to scale up the production of MSG, because you can't just take seaweed and just extract it. It's just not enough. So he figured out that you can take wheat gluten and hydrolyze it with hydrochloric acid. And basically it turns most of the gluten into amino acids. And a lot of it, about 30 or 40% of it, is glutamic acid. The term gluten actually comes from the high concentration of glutamic acid in it. So that became kind of like their production formula. It was just like, let's just hydrolyze this and get glutamic acid. So that is in the form of MSG because, again, it has that really nice solubility. And that's just a way to add umami to dishes and increase its intensity of savoriness. There's not really anything particular about it. By the time we get to the 60s and 70s, they discovered that they could just grow glutamic acid in a microorganism. And so that's what they've been doing, is just sort of fermenting a nice broth of glutamic acids that they extract. As far as nowadays, why it's so kind of, you know, it's been problematic is because... Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people, so this is where it gets tricky, because it's heavily used in Japanese and Chinese cuisine, and really all Asian cuisine uses a lot of MSG. And there's this idea that when you eat Chinese food, you get sort of like really intense headaches. Like, people talk about this Chinese food syndrome. It's a very interesting.
Really?
I am
so outside of the loop on this kind of stuff. I've never heard this.
So if you go on Google Scholar, you type in Chinese food syndrome.
Google Scholar, nonetheless.
Yeah,
wow.
Google Scholar. Like, it's that well verified as sort of a phenomenon. But, you know, the perception is that it's due to the high concentration of MSG. But that has been debunked scientifically. It is actually speculated that the types of ingredients used beyond just MSG actually cause a lot of these effects, or it's really psychosomatic. And there is some speculation, there is one or two research paper that possibly there's a cultural element where it's like, you know, people are afraid of Asian food, and so they like blame it for having like this high concentration of MSG. So yeah, there's a lot of these myths that have grown around MSG. And with that, this idea that it's artificial or it's synthetic, even though, you know, it's basically biosynthesized in a bioreactor, much like it would be with alcohol, for example, not particularly novel or different. So it's a tough thing that people are kind of going through as far as all of this is have no MSG, or like people want things that don't have MSG, which is funny because if you take soy sauce, or you take miso, or you take, you know, all these fermented foods, even cheese, they have very high concentrations of glutamic acid. So, I mean, you're kind of just switching one for another, unless you just don't eat any of those things. That's my take on it.
So I guess that gets right to the point of why the articles you sent and kind of why they exist. It was like trying to get to, it's not necessarily get rid of it, but to bring people's confidence in what they're buying. So kitchen type chemistry was the buzzword from the discipline, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that research was really trying to describe how to get that right. Find safe compounds from natural materials. So you can, yeast extract is the one I see all the time that takes the place of MSG.
If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblokes.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
That are in the food. So that's what those two articles were really about, right?
Yeah, exactly. Kind of finding a new way to get to sort of a clean label or natural. I'm going to put it in quotes because
yeah, of course.
My opinion is not too many things that are natural. And the idea there is just, you know, developing a method to produce these high intensity umami compounds that's, you know, can basically pass through an ingredient label and no one's gonna, you know, feel, you know, disgusted by it.
In other words, they can pronounce it. I think listeners probably see the pattern to the show. I usually ask my guest for a peer-reviewed paper or two, and to fully put it in their wheelhouse and maximize our learning, i.e. my learning. So we've kind of covered the summary, but those two papers were looking for safe additives to hit that savory spot. So how were these molecules chosen? I mean, is there some theory or broader data that, like, I don't know organic chemistry. I tried my best to stay away from it. One of the reasons why I took geophysics instead of geochemistry was basically that. So what is it they're looking for? How do they build these molecules, or what molecules are they looking for based on the theory? Like, what is that theory?
Yeah, definitely. It's really fascinating. So what happened was this Japanese chemist had a bunch of students, and one of them was sort of his star student, right? And he ended up discovering one of those ribonucleotides that we were talking about, sort of have that higher synergy intensity from, I believe it was either from shiitake mushrooms or from bonito flakes. But he was able to discover it, and it was, it's called inosinate or inosinic acid. Basically, it's just like a byproduct of RNA degradation. So, you know, the prevailing theory is like, okay, now we've got glutamic acid and we got an inosinic acid, and that's pretty exciting, but no one knew how to make that at large scale. And then in the 60s, another Japanese chemist, or a group of them, were able to discover another ribonucleotide that also enhanced umami even more. And this one was called guanylinic acid, which is very similar in structure to inosinic acid. But
did I know that from somewhere?
No.
Okay. Just checking.
But the point being is that, like, okay, so you have inosinic acid and it's got, you know, one hydrogen group, and then replacing that hydrogen group is a amine group, right? So it's now it's a little bulkier, it's a little fatter. And so suddenly they were like, wait a second, so it has a higher intensity, so maybe let's like swap that nitrogen, let's shove other stuff in there. And so they went on this like crazy journey of synthesizing like every known possible structure that they could possibly do with the organic chemistry techniques that they had at the time, which was like 20 or 30 iterations of these ribonucleotides. Because like Ajinomoto was like a very successful company and they were making a ton of money, so they're like, let's like even crank it up even higher. So they started like putting oxygen there, and they put like sulfur in place of that. They were putting like large groups on there and smaller groups and different architectures and structures, hoping that maybe one of them would give them insight. And they discovered that if you put a sulfur compound in place of that nitrogen group, it really like takes off. It's like on a different level. So that was discovered through synthetic chemistry, but it was just really hard to make. Like, it's just not feasible, especially for, you know, a food ingredient. You know, we're not talking about pharmaceuticals here. We're talking like commodity ingredients, you know, basically salt. I mean,
they gotta be cheap. In other words,
they gotta be cheap. So, you know, that was basically abandoned. They had all the technology to do it. It just wasn't economically feasible. So now come, you know, 2010, 2020, there's a group in Germany led by, I think it's Thomas Hoffmann. And he's just been able to like kind of break this little impasse that's been going on and basically synthesize these compounds, these sulfur containing compounds using food ingredients. Right. Like just, you know, you take sugar, you take an amino acid like glycine, which is found commonly in food, and one of these, you know, ribonucleic acids or ribonucleotides. And then you mix it with, you know, a sulfur compound that can just come from onion or garlic. You know, there's a lot of sulfur compounds in those. You mix them together. And then now all of a sudden you've got like this super high intensity umami flavor enhancer. Which is so exciting because, you know, we have things like aspartame and, you know, these like high intensity sweeteners, like we've known those for ages, but we've never had like something feasible as far as like umami high intensity savoriness, you know, increaser. So it's really cool. Like, and it, in my line of work, it's like actually really exciting because, like, you know, for like the past 110 years or 20 years, there hasn't been like that many super exciting discoveries.
You really should not say it's so cool. You should say it's so delicious. I mean,
so delicious.
Yeah. So we're not totally leaving this yet, but I want to point out the fact that these two papers both make use of wavelengths. So they're perfect for the show. In fact, every science is perfect for the show. Everyone uses wavelengths. In the paper's case, they use mass spectrometers and spectroscopy to ensure the produced chemical components are pure. And I assume that's just as expected. Mm-hmm. In broad terms, that is the purpose of them in these papers, right? Is to ensure the quality.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
So I guess the question becomes, are there practically used by companies in, say, a factory today to make sure that the incoming ingredients are always the same? Or is there some way to do this on the fly? Or are they assuming the company that makes that ingredient has already done that?
Yeah, so typically you'll send it out, like either the company that makes the ingredient or the company that brings in the ingredient will send it out to a lab, and they'll do sort of the basic spectroscopy. They don't, I don't remember if they use mass spectrometry. that often, just because it's so expensive. I think actually mass spectrometry, I can never pronounce that, is best used for fraud, actually food fraud, determining if someone, for example, someone has been making and filling up a wine and saying, you know, a champagne, when it's actually, you know, some Napa Valley like knockoff.
I will say, though, in academia, you use what you have available at your own institution. So in this particular case, for a science article, it wouldn't surprise me if that was the cheapest because it was there. But
right.
Just from my own experience in academia.
Yeah. Yeah. Companies are probably much the same in that sense, unless it's like really, really critical. Right. Like no company is like hanging out with like a NMR. Right. Like, yeah. Unless you're like a pharmaceutical company where it's like essential. But food industry, we're very cheap. We just don't make that much money at the end of the day.
Yes. Importantly, I'm a scientist. I like writing numbers and I like measuring things. And they measured the taste of umami through taste testers? Mm-hmm. How do you normally do this? Is there like a synthetic receptor and you measure it that way, or do you really use people?
So what's interesting is that we have been able to develop electronic tongues, but the problem is that they don't provide the subjective experience, right? So, you know, you can never really quite map them out. And plus, electronic tongues are only as good as, you know, the information you're really feeding them. So like, fine, you can determine the concentration, but the concentration doesn't tell you anything about how a person perceives it. So there's a whole branch, there's a sub-discipline known as sensory science, in which all sorts of statistics are applied to determining how you can take a group of people and you can basically create metrics out of an intensity of, you know, for example, sweetness. And they actually did this back in the 90s to develop a new soda flavor, where a statistician basically made, he didn't himself, but the company made all sorts of iterations of the soda, like just like tiny changes in the concentration and sweetness and in the color and all sorts of things. There's like 5,000 participants who and they're all trained, right? So the idea here is that they're trained for very specific indicators, and they are able to provide, like, you know, quantifiable information. So, you know, it's a scale from, let's say, 1 to 100 or 1 to 10 or something like that. But you just take enough of these people and then you apply some kind of statistical analysis, you're able to find some trends. It's not perfect, but it gives you an eye into what do people actually like. And so the same thing goes with these papers, is where they take the trained panelists who are trained in recognizing different properties of umami, its longevity, its intensity, you know, if there's changes in the umami, like longitude and latitude. It's like wild, actually, like how these people get kind of worked into this. So that is, in fact, you know, one of the quantifiable ways that you determine sort of the subjective experience, which is really funny, right? Like, yeah, it's tricky. It's kind of like psychometrics or like, you know, psychological.
Yeah, but you're taking such a big enough sample that you're trying to get over the fact that it's completely subjective. I mean, it's always subjective, but you have enough sample that you should at least get to an average population scale for the group that you have. So I would imagine these people would, because you mentioned earlier about the flavors of the mouth or your receptors depend a bit on your ancestry through genetics. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine you also have to have a population that is either broad to take on all the genetics, or you assume you're going to stay within one group and say, well, for this genetic group, this is the number.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's. And, you know, there's obviously such variation, like, you know, they're not including people from, you know, South America or Africa, right? Like, and they have very different taste buds. I mean, and to me, that's, I think that's why we have so many different cuisines, is because because there is a genetic component to what people like and don't like. And so, you know, you kind of like sum up the average of what do people like, and then somehow you have these cuisines.
Okay, so we're going to start pivoting and starting to go back out. But I want to, part of that going back out, we'll focus on you and patents. Now, just me as an aside, because I deal with a lot of conspiracy theorists online being on social media and science, they often use patents as a way to circumvent talking about peer-reviewed science, and they cannot take the place of it. They are still very useful. They just serve different purposes, and the standards are completely different. So I know your patents are, in your case, I guess, you're applying science, which is peer-reviewed, to create something that you patent, right?
Right, right. But the, you know, who's peer reviewing it, I wouldn't necessarily say is the most scrupulous in terms of the, you know.
You're referring to the scientific peer review. And yes, right? Are you talking about the peer review?
No, I'm talking about the patent, like the way.
Okay. So patents, I know, go through a review process, but is it actually reviewed by scientists in the field?
No.
See, that's where I was like, there's a difference. Like, they are reviewed, but they're not peer reviewed.
Right.
And that's why I always like to make that distinction, because they're two different. But you've used peer reviewed science to create your patent. What are they, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah. So I have two patents in design of, it's basically a growth regulator or enhancer for cannabis. I was working with someone that was really involved in cannabis.
It's completely legal here in Canada, so I mean,
yeah, it was actually in Canada. So yeah, it was perfect. It wasn't anything particularly remarkable in my opinion. It's just, you know, there's a blank spot in sort of the technology, and I just found some papers that, you know, okay, you take this one paper that's talking about this particular combination, and there's another paper that's talking about another combination, but they haven't studied the combination of the combination. So, you know, it's like, okay, I'm pretty sure if you take, like, if it hasn't actually been tested, maybe like there's some negative consequences, but pretty sure if you take these two combinations and make a third combination, that you're going to see some difference. And so that's kind of like, you know, it's like, to me, it's kind of like backyard chemistry, right? Like,
not sure. I mean, I would argue the cannabis industry hasn't quite hit its full stride yet as far as the science portion of it. It's getting there, but I mean, it's really hard when you've spent how many decades completely under criminal statutes. So it's just not there. But I mean, you're also, like you said, you're doing that translation portion. You're taking the science, translating it in this case into business, and applying to own the terms of that for business purposes. I think this is great. I mean, even if you're not a scientist or you're young and looking at it, there's always work in science, including business. So you can be a scientist and a business person. That's not me. I tried it once and failed miserably, but that's neither here nor there. So we've gotten a little bit of your own patents and going from the science to the business. We've looked at how Umami has changed over time from basically 1906 to today. But where is food science going? When I ask variations on this question, it always seems to come back to machine learning. Is that going to be the same here, where we're using machine learning to do that process of building different chemicals based on patterns and recognition for new tastes? Or are we... you got somewhere else for this to go?
It's interesting. I think, you know, it's kind of split in the food industry. There's definitely people who use machine learning and sort of spit out the term AI, right? As far as like trying to make these combinations of different recipes. And then certainly I've dabbled a little bit where I've tried to, you know, take a bunch of data, try to find some kind of pattern. The problem is like there's just so much noise, right? Like there's this issue that we're talking about where you have variation genetically. And then also just people have preferences. Like there's just people don't like certain things. And that changes. That changes remarkably within year after year. So, you know, as much I think as people would like to save money, and not have to hire people to taste stuff and then build it and taste it and then build it and taste it. At the end of the day, I mean, a machine is only, again, only as good as the information that you feed it. And until we have a full scope of what it means to taste something, I don't know how exactly someone's going to be able to mimic that. Again, I mean, they're just numbers at the end of the day. It's going to be really challenging to create something. But I think...
Well, then what is going to go? What is going to push food science forward then if it's...
Yeah, yeah. That's, I think a lot of it is going to be, you know, synthetic biology. You know, being able to construct new molecules or even pre-existing molecules in microorganisms or other plants. So an example, a really cool example, is there's a company out in North Carolina where they take monk fruit, so the compound that actually makes monk fruit sweet, and they shove it into watermelons. And the reason why is because watermelons are genetically similar to where monk fruit comes from. So now you've got watermelons with a ton of monk fruit sweetener, right? And then you can extract it, and that, you know, in theory will make it cheaper. So that's an example. And then another one is, you know, vanilla extract is actually quite expensive. It's one of the most expensive spices, and it's quite rare. There's only 5 regions of the world where vanilla grows, and like 80% of it is Madagascar. So, you know, because of climate change and because of projective issues with pests and blight, you know, it's the cost of vanilla is just going to skyrocket. So the issue there is, like, how do you make vanilla, like, actually really good tasting vanilla? And so flavor companies have been working really hard to design, you know, production systems where they take the genes that the vanilla plant has and shove them into microorganisms to spit out vanilla. It's still very rudimentary. I mean, it's really just the one molecule of vanillin that gives you the vanilla flavor, which is not as complex as the vanilla pod. So how do you replicate the vanilla pod? And the same is true for chocolate. The same is true for all sorts of different flavors. I even speculate at some point we're going to run out of varieties of, say, like strawberry, right? And so our only understanding of strawberry will be a very narrow scope, very narrow idea in the future, where there's only like 2 or 3 varieties of strawberries. And then we just kind of replicate that flavor. But like, that doesn't capture the nuance of a lot of different flavors.
Wow. That brings up a whole other topic that maybe I'll leave alone, of like farming and, you know, using farming only one particular type of variety. I mean, we've lost lots of varieties of apples already, for instance.
Right, right.
Tomatoes are the same way.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
So saving their flavors through food science instead of biology. An interesting take on things, for sure. Okay, I've got 2 more questions, and one of them, okay, where do you want to go, like, in your career? I mean, like, what do you want to create? Is there a goal on your bucket list, like the best tasting ice cream, or making 2 flavors work even though convention says they shouldn't, like pickle banana ice cream? I don't know. Is there something on your bucket list that you're like, I would love to do that?
Yeah, I'm actually in a really interesting spot in my sort of consulting business, where, you know, I feel like I've done a lot of those types of projects, and, you know, I've been really, there's things that I've been really excited about, and I've sort of achieved. And so the next question is, like, what do I want to do? And I think a lot of it is probably going to be, you know, learning more about how do you make flavors from that kitchen level chemistry, where like people have accessibility, and possibly even making open source, but like you still have the rigor of like, this is actually what's happening, versus, you know, like, all right, I'm gonna like cook my, you know, pasta sauce, but I have like no clue what's happening in there, right? Like I just know what grandma did, right? Like,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not, there's no like correlation. So I think that, to me, that's really fascinating, is like, how do you take, you know, these, you know, what are arguably just a lot of chemical processes. And then you create sort of a theory around it. And that's my sort of hope is like I can create some kind of cooking theory based on like chemical principles.
Gordon Ramsay, look out. Brian's coming for you.
I'm coming for you.
Okay, so the traditional last question, and it is the question I ask every guest. What is your favorite science joke?
Okay.
It's also seemingly the question that some guests really, really dread, even though I warn every single one that this is the last question.
It's true, right? That's, you know, I don't know if I can do it justice, but I think it's kind of funny, which is, you know, why did the potato hate the banana?
I have no idea.
Because they were starch enemies.
That's perfect. That's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. That is like picture perfect, whimsical wavelengths, dad joke. I'm surprised I didn't use it at the top of the show.
Perfect.
Well, that brings it to a close. And thank you so much, Brian, for agreeing to come on Whimsical Wavelengths. And I'll see you guys all in 2 weeks. Hope you enjoyed it, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. Appreciate it.
And there we have it. Another episode of Whimsical Wavelengths has come to a close. You know what that means? It's time, if you haven't already, to hit subscribe. You have no idea what the next topic is going to be, and it might just be up your alley or your taste buds. So I hope to see you all, or I hope to have your ears again, in 2 weeks' time on another episode. Till then, remember, hit the subscribe. If you can, join the Patreon, or just interact on social media. Instagram, Facebook, and Blue Sky. Thanks.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light, riding the waves that are just out of sight. In a world so chaotic that misbehaves, melodies that echo show us it's always. Colors intertwine, painting the sky. We're lost in the rhythm as the universe flies by. Oh, we're tuned in, feeling the beat of the unknown. Can you hear it? It's echoing through your bones. And this melody